Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. It's been almost 2 years since the world woke up to the coronavirus. And now with new variants like Omicron, will we ever get the pandemic under control? Let's get to the bottom line. What started with one case of the flu in Wuhan, China, has left more than 5 million people around the world dead in less than 2 years, 800,000 of them in the United States alone. Scientists have discovered new mutations like Lambda and Delta and the current wave of Omicron with no end in sight. They've also created amazing vaccines and medicines to deal with the virus, which brings us to the cycle we're stuck in now. New surges and variants of illness, coupled with new measures to try to manage it, and a clear distinction between the haves and the have-nots of the world. Vaccination rates in rich countries have reached about 70%, but most of the world vaccination rates are hovering around 5% of the population. So as this year wraps up, what lies in store for us in 2022? And can scientists create a pan-virus vaccine? Today we're talking with Dr. Eric Topol, a cardiologist who founded the Scripps Research Translational Institute, focusing on genomics and the author of many books on the future of medicine. I am a big fan. And most recently, Deep Medicine, How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Healthcare Human Again. Eric, it's great to see you. And I just want to start out with this issue about something that you've been writing about with the Omicron virus and understanding the data. Let me just ask you to give our audience an understanding of how serious the evolution of these variants are and how prepared we are or aren't for dealing with them.
Well, first, Steve, it's great to be with you. Knowing you for many years and having a chance to weigh in on this whole pandemic and Omicron. You know, if it hadn't been for the evolution of the virus, we would have been done with this pandemic many, many months ago. But unfortunately, right around Thanksgiving was the first report of the Omicron variant, which is the most challenging by far. It really takes the vaccines that we have today and makes them less effective, makes even the booster dose, the third dose, not as effective as what we've seen with all the previous variants. So this so-called immune escape is a problem. And, of course, we don't know if the virus will stop evolving here. If we don't contain it, which, as you started in your intro about not having the global vaccine equity and covering the planet, unless we get containment, we could see further evolution and complete escape from our vaccine and infection immunity. So this is another major bump in the road as we try to get an exit ramp from the pandemic to an endemic state.
Do you think that we understand the complexities of these virus well enough in its evolution to understand whether it is evolving in a more deadly way, a less deadly way? You know, I remind people that our, you know, annual flu vaccines are essentially, you know, caused by a very deadly variant of the flu at some point that evolved and became less deadly over time. Is there any chance that might be the vector that COVID-19 takes?
Well, you know, this virus is so different than flu. Flu is a hypermutation virus, and that's why our vaccines are not very good. We can't keep up with the mutations or predict them very well. Here, we've only had five major variants in over 2 years evolve, with the Omicron being by far the most difficult to deal with. But, you know, the capability for us to develop a coronavirus vaccine for this family of the SARS-CoV virus is imminent. It's in our reach. And there's been so much progress about that. And that's what we should be doing right now, instead of trying to come up with a Omicron-specific vaccine, which appears to be necessary if we're going to start to get hold of and control of this particular variant. So, you know, we can do better. The science has been, as you touched on, just remarkable. And even though influenza has never yet had a universal vaccine, the coronavirus, it lends itself much better to that.
You know, you have just mentioned the science has been remarkable. I'll tell the, you know, the folks that have, you know, you haven't been through this before. If you're a young person, developing a vaccine for a virus in a year was unheard of. It's practically miraculous. Operation Warp Speed came up with a set of variants. But, Eric, you also wrote something a while back, and I'm just going to paraphrase it. It says, it brings us to the United States sitting in the zone of denial for then the fourth time during the pandemic, thinking in some way that it's going to be immune to what's happening in the world. And so I find this juxtaposition of almost willful ignorance sitting right next to profound, successful science. You know, one of the most alarming elements of this time, but I, you know, as we say in this business, can you separate the signal from the noise here? What's happening, particularly in the United States, with this denial of science and what it, and the lessons and benefits it's offering us?
Yeah, no, this is truly incomprehensible to me. Now we're in the fifth denial of Omicron. We have 120,000 new cases a day. We have 67,000 people in the hospital, over 1,200 deaths a day, and we haven't even yet seen the Omicron effect. So we are looking at a very serious potential of more than a million new cases a day in the United States, but yet we're not doing anything about it. We're not containing Delta, and we have more trouble lying ahead. So this continued repetitive notion that what's happening in South Africa or Europe or wherever is not going to happen in the United States, it's pure stupidity. And I'm just amazed that it continues.
Now, there were various institutions created over the last decade. One of them I'm familiar with is the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. We also knew of simulations done by the U.S. government as well as European governments anticipating how to behave, how to react before the next pandemic comes. The Rockefeller Foundation has worked with people like Dr. Rick Bright, who is very, you know, to basically set up new institutions, you know, to look at this. I guess my question to you is, I see a lot of these institutions that have come online. What, in your view, from a science view, but you're also so savvy with blind spots in science and blind spots in public policy, what blind spots do we really need to remove? What leadership do we need to see to fix what still looks to me like a wobbly response to the next pandemic?
Right. Well, the first year of our pandemic response was checkered by a pure political botch, bungle. And, you know, I worked with the Rockefeller Foundation on the action plans, which we submitted to the White House and the government. They were just ignored, totally ignored. This year, with the new administration, we have other problems. We have infighting among the leadership. We have the inability to execute with respect to getting rapid tests out there, which are essential and should be free. It should be available for every household. And, you know, it's just not happening. So that, along with, you know, the booster issue, we knew about this in August from Israel. And we basically ignored and said, well, we don't have U.S. data. Well, that's another issue in this second year of the pandemic in the U.S. Our navigational system, our data tracking is pathetic. You know, we don't have a handle on the breakthrough hospitalizations and deaths that are occurring, no less all of the hospitalizations with respect to all of the demographics, the genomic sequence of the virus. And these are just the most extreme cases. So data tracking and not having rapid tests have not improved whatsoever in this country, despite the urges of all of us that we have to get this resolved, because, you know, we have a lot more months, if not the whole year of 2022, to get through in this pandemic. And, you know, it's taken much too long to get this on track.
You know, I can't agree with you more. When I was in Paris and I needed to get a rapid test, look, there was a tent outside my hotel. There were tents all over Paris. You could easily get an immediate test almost anywhere on the spur of the moment. If you were a French citizen, it was free. For me, it was 30 euros, you know, but it was there and available. Today, yeah, in the United States, it's so hard. There are places you can go, but you've got to be, you know, a kind of a complex game player to find out where they are, then to navigate the costs, et cetera. So I guess my question is, why isn't the scientific community screaming at the Biden administration to work out this dysfunction, to prioritize tests, I mean, we used to talk about contact tracing. No one, I mean, you laugh. If you mention contact tracing, people laugh. So there seems to be an abandonment of all the public health steps that were being advocated during the Trump administration. It seems like the Biden administration isn't even trying. Do I have that wrong?
Well, I think it's not far off. We have been screaming. I've been screaming, Michael Mina, many others, to get this rapid test, you know, right. And in Colorado now, they are free to all people in the state. And as you say, in select places, like in some of the few cities in the U.S., it's like what you described in Paris. But that's, you know, a tiny, tiny fraction of the U.S. And you know, it just is truly unexplainable. This is the contact tracing, as you say, we're starting to see that for Omicron for the first time in the pandemic, that, oh, wow, we ought to do some contact tracing here. But, you know, we haven't done public health 101, and that is what made the U.S. performance, you know, giving it an F. Great on the science, you know, A-plus for the vaccines and so many other aspects of the science advances that have been centered here. But far as managing the pandemic, it has just been horrible.
You know, one of the things I would recommend to our audience to do is to go read Eric Topol's Twitter feed, because it is a quick lesson. I mean, it's deeper than most out there, but it's a quick lesson in many of the different dimensions of the spread of a pandemic, this pandemic, how to respond, what the deficits in policy are. But you also highlighted who you felt were heroes on the team in South Africa who identified and then tried to say, it's here, it's here, it's here, went through a process of trying to tell the world about it and what to watch for. And it wasn't easy, which was surprised me. So tell us why you saw them as heroes and why what they did was so important and what lessons we should take from it and replicate with possible variants down the road.
Right. Well, you know, we saw in the prior variants, Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, those four, it took quite a while for the world to be alerted about the presence of a variant of concern. And variant of concern, you know, that's a big deal. Like I said, there's only been five. But with Omicron, it was a whole different look. Tulio de Oliveira and his colleagues in South Africa, the South African Ministry, the CRISPR organization, what they did was just extraordinary, because they knew by announcing this Omicron variant with the sequence that they had and the outbreak in Gauteng, the province, that that was going to create trouble for South Africa. And indeed, what happened, Steve, it's just horrible that their travel was banned from South Africa as a result of announcing the Omicron variant. I mean, it's just extraordinary. But that... within 2 days, the WHO had an emergency meeting, labeled it, categorized it a variant concern, and we've seen what it's been doing now throughout the world. I mean, throughout Europe and Denmark and Norway and Belgium and the UK, what it's going to do in the US. Basically, it has destiny as becoming the dominant new strain throughout the world unless it doesn't compete fully with Delta. So it's really the South Africans that, you know, within days instead of months, that took this Omicron variant and gave us awareness, that gave us a head start. So getting back to like what you mentioned earlier, Steve, the ability to do contact tracing, we got on this in the U.S., even though there was some delay in getting the first sequences in the U.S. Now it's, you know, everywhere, but we got to those cases very shortly after they arrived, very shortly after community transmission was started. And we owe that debt to the South African scientists.
Let me ask you, you know, talk about, you know, cutting off travel. And there seems to be, you know, in this drama, this major health pandemic drama, a desire in some places to blame a country, to blame a place, as opposed to saying, hey, you did the right thing by stepping forward because of the consequences that would come out. And as we know and as we've seen, you know, once you've identified it, it's likely already out somewhere else. I mean, this was, you know, part of the lesson we didn't learn before. But, you know, it does raise these interests of divides in the world. And let's listen to what South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, had to say recently.
Now, I have personally really been disappointed in the approach that the rich countries have taken on the issue of vaccines. Firstly, they hoarded vaccines. They ordered more vaccines than their populations required. And when we wanted vaccines, they just kept, you know, giving us the crumbs from their table.
I am interested in this because there seems to be, along the lines of what you were critiquing the United States for doing, a sense that if we take care of it here, we're okay. That we don't have to worry about the developing world or other corners of the world that may have this. And I'm just interested in it from you, what we need to do in terms of approaching a whole world solution to dealing with this pandemic.
Right. Well, you know, it is clear that we have to do much better. The continent of Africa has been almost completely ignored with respect to getting the people vaccinated there. And South Africa, with 25% fully vaccinated, is one of the outliers on the in the positive side. But as you noted, you know, many countries are well over 70, even 80, approaching 90% now. The problem we have, though, is not just the global equity. The United States is an outlier, contributing an enormous number of new cases each day. So we have under-vaccinated. You know, we are ranked number 67 in the world in the United States for vaccination, which is so incredible, having the mRNA vaccines originated from the U.S. work. So as far as inequity, there's also inequity of the case burden, which is the breeding grounds for yet another variant, which could even be worse than Omicron. So we have to look at both of these. You know, where there's tremendous number of new cases and spread, we've got to put the fire out. And so we need to attend to both the under-vaccinated parts of the world, the low and middle-income countries, but also the culprits. And the U.S. is culprit number one as a country. Obviously, the continent of Europe is also contributing a lot of cases, but no country like the U.S. right now.
Do you think we should be much more forceful when it comes to mandates than our system has been so far, either at the federal level or the state level, that this notion that some folks can sit it out, and that's their right, versus the collective health of American society and global society? You know, are we getting the equilibrium right between those two poles?
Right. Well, Steve, we haven't gotten the equilibrium right, and it's very sad that mandates even had to come up as an issue, because you would have thought that all Americans would want to be united against a formidable foe of this virus. But it hasn't happened. And we have a balkanized country with very profound politicization of vaccines and masks and the science and everything else. And that's what's held us back. All the misinformation and disinformation and the politics. And that's really the best explanation of how we have failed. And how we are number 67 in the world of countries that are fully vaccinated right now and sliding, you know, every week further down the list. So, you know, we're performing in terms of vaccination much worse than many countries that are not even in the developed world right now. And we can account for that just because of the politics, the lack of community sense. And we have to then resort to mandates. But as you've seen, Steve, we have courts, we have governors and states taking this on, and we haven't been able to make the progress. We can't even get healthcare workers to have mandated to be fully vaccinated, no less the rest of the population.
Why have we not, you know, filled that gap with the developing world and gotten them the vaccines? And so they're calling, as the South African president said, for a waiver of these, because they want the IP to be able to, you know, reach their audience. But why haven't we taken the obvious course, which is just to pay for vaccines for this developing world, because it's also paying for our health?
Right. No, we should be not even just paying, but, you know, donating vaccines in enormous supplies, not little piddly amounts. Also, we need to set up production facilities in other continents and much faster than that's been happening. So we haven't had this, you know, true humanitarian, global, overarching objective. There's been so much nationalistic behavior, not just in the U.S., of course, but throughout many other countries. There's been this big fight about boosters and how that's detracting from getting other countries to their initial vaccination. But frankly, you have to do both, because if you lose the protection for the people who are vaccinated, you're, particularly with Omicron, you're basically back to square one. So we have to get this right. We're not moving fast enough. Whereas we got, as you noted, within 10 months of the sequence, we had vaccines that were taken through pivotal large phase three trials. But in order to get the production, the manufacturing, distribution, and supply chain of the vaccines throughout the world, we have not come up with a parallel high-velocity strategy.
Eric, which you know, if you're basically a family person here, worried about your children, worried about your, you know, grandparents, you know, others out there, you know, there's been a lot of different information and signals sent regarding which vaccine to take to deal with Omicron, how effective it is. It's almost, and I understand as a person in the news business, how hard it is to be formulaic and to issue, you know, precise instruction to people. But almost the debate about efficaciousness of these drugs translates into uncertainty and a big question mark. And I'm just interested from you, if you're advising people, what's the best step forward? Is it Pfizer? Is it AstraZeneca? Is it Johnson & Johnson? Is it Moderna? Is the booster critical? Well, you know, what's your best counsel to people who don't know a lot but want to go down the right path?
Well, it partly depends on where you are in the world because different vaccines are available. In the U.S., it's basically, you know, Pfizer and Moderna. And now it's very clear that a third shot is going to be necessary for those to maintain effectiveness against Omicron. But if there's, for J&J, which is the cousin of AstraZeneca, these are adenoviral vaccines, the difference with J&J, it was supposed to be a one and done. It's not true. You really need to have at least two shots. We don't know about a third. And it's probably advisable to take an mRNA second shot for J&J or a mRNA that's Pfizer or Moderna for AstraZeneca. We're seeing a really nice effect of this mixing. That is, you had an adenoviral vaccine like AstraZeneca or J&J, and then you get an mRNA vaccine. And that appears to be this boost beyond just a boost, which is the different types of vaccines are more than additive for the immune response. So that's one thing we could do. And as you're, I think, getting to, Steve, that's not what the manufacturers recommend or the government recommend in general. There are some exceptions. But for people, that would be a very prudent approach to get the maximum, the biggest bang out of vaccination. So, you know, we at the moment have seen a consistent edge of Moderna over Pfizer, about 8 to 10 percent points for efficacy. That's held up, but with the waning, the same type of waning, that's likely due to the higher dose of mRNA of Moderna over Pfizer. Remember, right, it's 100 micrograms compared to 30 micrograms. But, you know, now the booster of Moderna is 50. And we're also seeing, you know, now the children, age 5 to 11, the teens. So this dosing and the different vaccines, there's lots of different issues when you start to get into different age groups of people.
Well, thank you for that. Well, we'll have to end it there. Cardiologist, scientist, author, Dr. Eric Topol, thank you so much for your candid thoughts today.
Thank you, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? 600 years ago, Galileo was punished by the Catholic Church for insisting that the Earth rotated around the sun. And today, despite us supposedly living in the age of science and rationality, the debate about the coronavirus reminds me about Galileo all the time. No matter how much disdain some folks have for science and scientists, guess what, folks? The coronavirus is here. The West is fighting it with masks and testing and vaccines and contact tracing and avoiding crowds. But for the majority of the world, all of these measures, even washing hands with clean water, is a really big challenge. In the end, the scientific approach is going to succeed. It's going to take time and money, but it is possible. And then all people on this planet should have fair access, no matter the continent, no matter the zip code. That's the only way. And that's the bottom line.